এক্ষণে আহিল। টকিং টু
ডিয়ার উইলফ্রিড রাইলি, I became aware of you because of some very unusual work you've done. At the height of the Black Lives Matter movement, with all of the calmness of the data-conscious social scientist, you've taken on questioning if the police violence expressed in George Floyd's horrific murder is actually endemic in its nature, or if it's more of a statistical outlier that has been inflated into mythical heights. So what was the starting point for you for exploring the question in your book, Hoax?
Well, there are two different books, really, that look at some of these questions. One is called Hate Crime Hoax, and that looks at the fact that a great many of these really high-profile stories of racial conflict in the States and in Europe as well have turned out to be complete hoaxes. I mean, these front-page stories of people having their hijabs ripped off during racial brawls, or Jussie Smollett, I mean, someone from my old hometown of Chicago who claimed on the coldest night of the year, he'd gone out to get a steak sandwich or something, and he was attacked by two racists with MAGA hats on, hoods, carrying nooses. I mean, Covington Catholic involved a group of students and athletes from my current state. The claim was they'd surrounded a Native American Indian elder. They'd been chanting violently. They threatened to take his, it's known as a rain drum away, all of this. None of these stories turned out to be true. So I looked at why this happened, and I ended up writing a book about the phenomenon. Sort of the appeal of victimization in the US and UK upper middle class, the desire of the media for sensational content that leads a lot of this to be put out. I mean, there's the old line, if it bleeds, it leads. So on down the line. And the second book, Taboo, that I wrote, other than one small academic monograph, looks at a deeper set of questions. And it kind of takes the idea of, excuse me, bullshit, but in popular culture, to a deeper level, where I look at the claims made by Black Lives Matter, the alt-right, by many groups of this kind that were in the public space, and I ask, are these real? So the claim, I mean, as you said, the George Floyd death is not an example. No one argues this is an example of good policing or something like this. I mean, there is a debate about whether the amount of drugs that Mr. Floyd had consumed would have sufficed to let the officer off in less tense times. But I mean, there's still a video of someone kneeling on another man in a fighting position for 8 or 9 minutes.
Awful.
The point is not that did not occur. It's that when you look at the claims that were made around the death of George Floyd, before that, the death of Michael Brown, a very persistent one was that this is endemic. As you said, America has its boot on the black man's neck, this kind of thing. What we actually found out when people like a good team from the Washington Post, which isn't exactly a right of center venue, myself, I'd note Heather McDonald at Manhattan Institute, we started actually unpacking these cases. What we found is that the total number of unarmed black men shot by police in a typical year is like 10. I mean, it's the highest number I've ever recorded is 50. That was in a year where it was over 100 males of all ethnicities. But last year, 18. The year before that, 12. That's roughly proportional, given that black people make up almost 14% of the U.S. population and have a higher than average crime rate. Again, you're talking out of a sample of perhaps 90 males total. So this just wasn't known. Kind of last point, but Skeptic Research Center, which is a small but very highly regarded think tank, looked at the question of how many individuals urban males thought were killed by the police. They asked black men and what you might call white hipsters, beards, bicycles, this kind of thing, all in the big New York, Detroit, Chicago. How many unarmed black males do you believe are shot annually by the police? A very simple question. And what they found was that the average urban male thought the figure was 10,000. Right. I don't want to exaggerate. There was like 40% thought it was 1,000 or well over. 15% thought it was 10,000. 8% thought it was more than 10,000. And again, the number is 12. So I began noting this and discussing this and got a fair amount of, I suppose, media notoriety for these dry academic articles where I was saying, well, no, this isn't true. You're overhyping this by three orders of magnitude. Because so many people, I believe, were reluctant to say that.
Yes. So, well, looking at the interactions between citizens and police in criminal situations, your findings really did contradict the generalized claims of a systemic racism, that black citizens are often killed disproportionately and almost at random by white policemen and vigilantes. The same logic is often extended well beyond the simple topic. We frequently hear that the differences in the black and white rates of arrest, incarceration, and sentencing, as well as the averaging sentencing length, all demonstrate racism. And you've pointed out how these arguments collapse whenever they're empirically tested using contemporary tools of science, such as multivariate regression, particularly when examining a particular population's characteristics, which is kind of interesting when reading a couple of your articles, how you look at how the population's characteristics are often mischaracterized when they're setting up studies. Can you explain this to us?
Sure. Yeah. No, I can expound on that a little bit. I think that, so first of all, the point you made is a very good one. I think there are several levels to it. I think level one is when you're talking with an intelligent man or woman of the left, their basic assumption is that disparities equal discrimination. So when I ask, show me racism, as someone who trained in the law and then trained as a social science methodologist, I mean, there are a fairly small number of successful class action civil rights cases every year and so on. So if I say, show me actual evidence of this, they won't say, well, no, you know, counselor, you're wrong. Although I'm not a practicing attorney at all at the moment. But I mean, they won't say, no, you're wrong about the number of actual situations that are in the public eye. What they would say is, well, look at these disparities between groups. So on the SAT, the standardized board exam, you have an average score of 950 for blacks, Native Americans only 912, Hispanics a bit above us, 970. But then you have Caucasians at 1120. What could cause that? Are you a believer in racial inferiority, sir? Or do you accept that there's some subtle racism out there? And in fact, this is a pretty invalid question. What I found is that when you began, and by the way, this is not a finding that's entirely original to me. I am a good statistician. I teach statistics and research methods at one of our state universities. But Thomas Sowell has pointed out a lot of this 70, 80 years ago. I mean, people from Milton Friedman to William Julius Wilson on the left have made this point. Charles Murray has made this point. But basically, when you're comparing two populations, you can't assume that both populations are identical in terms of every characteristic, except for that you're primarily interested in. So the argument that gaps between blacks and whites in terms of any performance variable are due to either racism or to genetic inferiority, which is essentially the claim of the alt-right, rest on the argument that there's no other possible difference between whites and blacks. And what we find is that that's just not true. I mean, a good paper in this field, June O'Neill, an actual research economist, goes back to 1991. And what she did was just make the obvious point. Well, African-Americans are three times as likely as whites to live in the South, which obviously is the region of the USA that's historically been the most backward. I mean, they don't like that description, but you have the most poverty, so on down the line. You must adjust for that. Then you've got age. The modal average age for a black man is 27, a white man it's 58. The median difference is over 10 years generally. Yeah, so you've got to do all this. You've got to put together a competent model in STATA or SPSS and then see what the residual effect is with all of this adjusted for. I mean, even if you're looking at test scores, there's a massive difference between groups and study time, which is not, except at the most secondary level, perhaps a genetic characteristic. Asians and Jamaicans and members of other minorities study extensively. But the white-black gap is about 2-1. And the test scores that result, one standard deviation below 1100 to 950, are exactly what you'd expect looking only at that. So when you, for the first time I did this, I was to some extent rechecking O'Neill. I just did Income Today. Mm-hmm. And the finding is identical. When you adjust for age, region, test scores, and training, study time, income gaps between blacks and whites essentially vanish. So you have to compare the same individuals. It makes no sense to compare a 58-year-old Jewish American or Italian American man in Manhattan with a 27-year-old black guy in Tupelo, Mississippi. So the same point, I'm going on a bit here. Same point for crime. I mean, you have to adjust for age at very first and so on down the line. There is a higher than average black crime rate, but many of the figures you see thrown around in kind of edgy literature are, again, it's the other side of the coin, right? The adjustments are not being made. So you'll simply say the black crime rate is 240% of the white crime rate. Black people are more urban, more working class, a decade or more younger, so on down the line. So this always should be done.
What fascinated me about your study is the stunning disproportionality between realities and beliefs. How the figures you came up with were remarkably different than what the public believed. You already talked about that, in the wake of the Black Lives Matter panic, large portions of the population were convinced that thousands and thousands of unarmed men were falling victim to police brutality. But we deem ourselves enlightened and live in an enlightened society. So please tell us how discovering this cognitive dissonance between belief system and reality has affected your thinking.
Well, I don't think it's affected my thinking all that much because okay. I'm kind of like always debunking. But no, I understand what you're saying. Like, what must people believe? But I mean, I think I am pleasantly free of this as a debunking researcher. When someone says something like, there was a lengthy debate on Twitter the other day about whether men liked dating and women liked sex or relationships were just entirely reciprocal. And I began with the starting point that most men do like going to dinner and most women do like sex. And there's a great deal of research indicating that this is true. So the panicking of our culture is sort of like voodoo. It only works on you. It only works on your competent adult brain if you are preconditioned to believe that this stuff is real. But again, with all of these questions, and they're great questions, there are layers here. So first of all, I think this happens because of the constancy of media culture in the USA and Western Europe. I mean, the cable networks, there are now, I think, 800 of them. I have Fubo or something like that in my house. You have 800 channels that have 24 hours in the day to fill. And then you have social media so that every one of your better known friends is a channel. And I mean, there are people like Ian Miles Chong, for example, on Twitter, no personal issue with the guy, but who have branded themselves in certain ways. So his brand is, I say the quiet part out loud, I believe. And I think he may have trademarked that, in fact. But this is on every one of his social media pages on the top line. So the focus of that account is going to be showing weird, wild incidents of violence between blacks and whites in either direction, usually black on white, women behaving badly, if you will, crazy stuff from LGBT subculture. I mean, I'd imagine that there are people who go to gay bars or swingers clubs and surreptitiously record. But so you have all the point is you have all of these channels that are putting out all of this content constantly. And we found that there are certain things that humans will respond to. A good friend of mine is a producer in local news, and he told me that the gold standard is an animal attack. It's not even a race or something. If someone's killed by a bear, you have 3 days worth of coverage. And here in the mountains, that does sometimes happen. So how many people are killed by bears or sharks? If you remember the famous Summer of the Shark in the USA, well, almost none, at 20 or something like that. But if every one of those cases gets 5 days of media attention, and this or more is what happens with, for example, police shootings of black men or black male attacks on whites, this sort of very rare thing, you're going to think that's extremely common. And this creates what Barry Glasner, Glasner B. from, I think, UCLA, the sociologist, called the culture of fear way back in 1999. And again, there are a lot of people, you know, I and my group of friends are quite good, but there are a lot of people that have had these ideas for decades, and they haven't always been allowed into the mainstream media to speak on them. Glasner looks at a list of 10 completely different things, like plane crashes, pit bull attacks, quote-unquote crack babies, terrors and panics we've now almost forgotten. And, you know, assesses how many children are actually born alive and fully addicted to crack cocaine and are untreatable per year. It was a very low number. I forget what it was. Young child kidnapping. I remember that number. The number of young people that are kidnapped for more than a week by someone who's a non-family member, not a loving, aggrieved dad, sexually abused, taken away. Every year, that's about 80. I mean, and these kids are generally recovered. They're intensively treated. There have been whole books written about them. So the idea that this is going to happen, if you're an upper middle class mother and you don't keep your kid on some kind of damn dog leash or, you know, you don't have a monitor, that they're going to be taken by someone is not true. And I mean, so I think that basically the answer to the question is you have this media ecosystem that thrives on constant fright. And so you have this, what H.L. Mencken once called an endless series of hobgoblins that are trotted out to menace the population, but none of them are real. I mean, for the white and black men that may be watching this, the person most likely to kill you is your wife. It's not nine warriors of another racial group. It's just you've angered your wife. There may have been domestic or sexual violence in either direction, and you get stabbed. So there are real risks in life. Bad diet is considerably ahead of that one, but they are not what we tend to be afraid of.
Yeah. So as a thinker of the last century has beautifully expressed, the idea that where desire becomes the father of thought, it also becomes the mother of illusion. Isn't this the phenomenon that we encounter, what sociologists call moral panic, that a society is losing itself in a phantasm? Doesn't this necessarily raise the question, why does a society fantasize about a story that's never happened?
Well, I think that there are... So the short answer to your question is, I think that we're using our old human instincts in a new world. So the phenomenon that you're describing, like miasmatic illusion shaping behavior, is actually known to the Hindu philosophers as Maya.
Sure.
They say it's one of the great risks of the world, that you will begin to pursue not, I'm not a Hindu philosopher, but I think a simple way to phrase this might be, you become distracted not by reality, but by the extrapolation of reality. Instead of pursuing those things that are likely to actually give happiness, you pursue things that are spelled out in explicit moral codes as the source of happiness. You guard against fears that you're told to have, whether or not they logically exist. So illusion is the coterie of things that are in your brain that do not reflect reality. And many of the people in this Hindu line were very critical of the ideas of karma and sin, by the way. As you guys probably know, they thought of them essentially as just layering bullshit on the world. So there is reality. There are sexual desires, for example, and you should control those to a degree, but they're basically healthy. The idea that there is an entire code of behaviors that's externally administered that regulates this is an example of illusion. It's something that you take on yourself unnecessarily. And I would tend to agree with this. But I mean, to some extent, the reason humans are so prone to this is that human beings are very unchanged from the people that ran north with our dogs and killed the last Neanderthals. I mean, when you actually look at things like studies of brain case size, not to get into some of the more phrenological work here, but just anthropological examination of humans, we've changed perhaps 5% since that period. We're a little shorter, we're a little more gracile or weaker, brain case is a little bigger, but other than that, we're the same cavemen. So in nature, it makes sense that certain instincts evolved and those would be mostly valuable. So, for example, my friend Brooks Crenshaw will say, former Special Forces guy here in the USA, that humans have a tendency to prioritize and notice the negative over the positive. Sure. For example, there are a number of studies where people look at tree branches and identify them as snakes. And it's not hard to see how that trait evolved in nature. If you're a bit of a paranoid, you know, you think everyone's an enemy. Your wife thinks curses are being placed on the family constantly. You look at a plant 8 times before you try it. That's conducive to continued life. If you look at something that might be a snake and freak out a bit and chop it with your blade, and it's actually a branch, nothing happens. If you just assume it's a branch and you're bitten by a poisonous snake, then you're dead. So there's a tendency among thinking people to prioritize the negative, to multiply risk extensively in your mind. So if you ask the average person what their chance of being physically attacked during a night out in a major city like Chicago is, they'll very consistently say 5% or 10%. And obviously, if that were the case, the city would be a complete charnel house. I mean, there'd be a million people out every weekend. Yeah, 10% of them would be killed or raped or something. We'd have to raise the place to the ground. No, your odds are something like 1 in 2,000. That's still quite high. There are an unfortunate number of victims when the nightclubs close every night and so on. But 5% is just you attempting to calculate what you think a low risk would be. And there's a natural facility in your brain that multiplies almost every potential risk well above what it is. So I guess the point that I'm making is this is why it's so easy to get these ideas going. There's a natural tendency to look at adult males of another ethnic group and think, Anada, enemy. There's a natural tendency to assume that certain things are fairly risky behaviors. And in our society, where we've almost eliminated risk in a lot of arenas, people aren't aware of that.
I can follow your anthropological argumentation, and in a way, you're pretty right. But I'm, as an elderly gentleman who's experienced a certain, like, enlightened society also, I'm kind of stunned by a certain infantilization, some kind of degradation of the public discourse in a way. And if you look for an incentive that underlies all these stories, it becomes quickly apparent that the scandal, be it racist, sexist, or politically motivated atrocity, is connected to something else and something very new, namely the attention economy. Isn't it because the scandal tempts the journalistic attention that instead of doing their due diligence, the journalists choose to follow a story that suddenly trends? What's the role of the attention economy in the emergence of a moral panic?
I think that's a great question. I mean, so this ties into what we've been talking about and expands it. So I don't really think it's debatable. I'm sure a research psychologist could come on and point out that I've used some terms incorrectly or something. But I don't think there's much debate that there are certain things humans respond to. Sexual stimuli, which is why women doing perfectly normal things on social media often pose bending over and so on. I mean, a fear, the terror of the other man, I think is one of them. Somewhat down the line, racial stimulation. Mm-hmm. So when you talk about the attention economy, what you have is a situation where on for-profit platforms, a lot of people have figured out how to exploit what I just described for money and likes. So, I mean, it's kind of a vicious spiral. It's a negative incentive set. I don't know how you'd describe it.
A business
but
model.
You know, yeah. Well, and yeah, mm-hmm. like, I mean, so I'm pretty sure you guys know this, but so Twitter X will pay you, and they've been paying you since Elon Musk took over to post content. And I'm a fairly popular Twitter figure. I have about 100,000 Twitter followers, but every couple of weeks I'll get a check for not far below the four figures, nothing crazy, but an income stream. And I would imagine that some of the players I'm describing probably make $300,000-$400,000 a year before going into YouTube and other platforms. Mm-hmm. So this is your job to some extent. And of course it's your job if you're a producer for the local news. So if you have two possible takes on something that you can present, one of which is just real, like, oh, this George Floyd killing is tragic, but it's one of 12 this year. Mr. Floyd was a drug addict who was involved. He was being arrested for counterfeiting. Still unfortunate. Let's put the cop on a desk for a couple of years and see if we need to sentence him to prison through a fair trial. Like, if you had that presentation, people would watch, they would nod respectfully, and then they would move on and you'd make $4. If your presentation is what was jokingly called down and to the left during 9/11, you keep showing the video under a headline that says murder, you know, with five exclamation points, you're going to get 80 times that much engagement. So all this goes together. And
yes, it does.
Interestingly enough, by the way, I think that the information economy and the likes economy, I think you guys called it the attention economy. When you use the term infantilization, I think that's very accurate. Many people spend a lot more time in sort of the fake world than they do in the real world.
The
average young American is on their phone for 7 hours a day. And you combine this with a lack of unstructured play where people used to go out and play football in the fields or something like that. That's now among the middle class on up. That's almost totally gone. I mean, people have play dates for their children from 3 to 7 p.m., this kind of thing. So I do think a lot of people spend a lot of time in this sphere. People use the term the manosphere, for example, for young men online, you know, arguing with young women, but almost never normally talking to them.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, a lot of people spend a lot of time in the unreal world and not enough time in the real world to have a valid basis for comparison, I think. Like some of those questions, do men and women enjoy dating each other, are only things you could ask if you are very inexperienced in actual life. But more people are today.
Yeah. Yeah. So if we consider the attention economy's role, we do end up in this very strange register, just as in the Jussie Smollett case, which you've investigated. An actor constructs this ludicrous story in which Trump supporters attack him at night. One of them's white. They pour bleach on him, put the noose around his neck, and they insult him, telling him it's MAGA country. in the attention economy's logic, this makes for an incredibly attention-riveting story, as you're talking about. And if following the laws of intersectionality, Jesse Smollett becomes a triple victim, a black man, a homosexual, and a campaigner for justice, creating precisely the desired scandalon, the story that turns on Twitter, generating a never-ending stream of sympathetic messages of support. And it's all about fame, about becoming a celebrity, what George Frankel describes in The Attention Economy. Unfortunately, the whole thing is a hoax, and it's so badly staged you doubt whether Jesse is really a very good actor. And in fact, he's paid two Nigerian brothers, neither of whom is white, to attack him, leading us to the heart of the problem. It's a hoax. It's a farcical comedy in which the usual suspects play the typical roles. And it's the only way to achieve the market reach and the social media fame desired. In this sense, the attention economy is almost an invitation to produce hoaxes. And can you explain this further?
Well, yeah, I think that what we're calling the attention economy incentivizes people to engage in all kind of behavior that you wouldn't normally engage in. I mean, I joked in passing about women and sometimes men bending over and filming OnlyFans content in public spaces. That's not normally something you do in the store without some kind of financial reward, or at least the reward of affection.
Sure.
And this is something you see fairly often. I mean, I've seen this happen at my gym a few times. I mean, it's difficult to know how to respond to it. I mean, people gyrating around with cameras pointed at them while you're, you know, trying to lift your body weight, it's a bit distracting.
It's a comedy.
It's very funny. And this is the secondary gym I work at. It's not a big deal, but it is something that you very definitely see. And I think the same thing is true with hate crime hoaxing or hate crime faking. So one of the questions that I had when I was writing the book Hate Crime Hoax is, why would someone do this?
Yeah.
You're technically committing a felony crime. You're falsifying a police report, an active investigation. What would make someone attempt this? Are people trying to get back at? One of the original hypotheses was people might be trying to target a university they hated or an ex-boyfriend or girlfriend with respectively a rape or domestic violence charge. That was very, very rare, actually. The answer was simply clout, might be a good way to put it, internet clout or community clout. People were aware that they were part of these left-leaning, and again, I don't mean to beat this term to death, but upper middle class, lower upper class communities, these aren't Ivies or state colleges. And they knew that they would receive a great deal of attention and positive attention at that, not even negative respect, for putting themselves into the position of the ultimate vulnerable victim that had to be coddled and petted and cosseted. So just as people in the past might have lied about athletic achievements or romantic conquests, people today very often seem to be lying about having been hurt, because we attach this point value. First, there's the attention economy in general. If you're in the public space in any way, whether it's dancing around awkwardly on a gun range or athletic facility, or it's having a story in the papers or something like that, you get attention. But secondarily, like, one of the most coveted kinds of attention now is the attention paid to the victim. And you see this if you spend any time on social media or dating platforms. I have a buddy who's a good-looking African-American guy, and he was talking with me about dating. And I'm in a stable relationship. I'm quite happy to be there right now, given what's going on. But this guy said, one thing I noticed is that there are no white women on dating platforms. And my response was, well, what are you talking about? That's 70% of the people every time I've gone on to Tinder or something like that years back. And his comment was, no one just says, I'm a well-adjusted, middle-class white woman. people will say, I am a... Yeah, no, I'm a neurodivergent, polyamorous goth who's 1/18th Cherokee. I'm a person of size as a term, or BBW as a term for being a little chubby. I mean, so it's just no one wants to be normal. People want to be in the victim categories that confer cachet. And that may be Byzantine eunuchs or something like that aside. That may be one of the first times this has ever happened historically.
Yeah, this is a weird change. We replaced identity by neg identity, a negative identity, victim Olympics, which absolutely bizarre, like in history. I was always asking myself, what's the real cause for it? If you go into the attention economy, we pay attention all day long, but we rarely save attention. The people who program, they do that. That made me re-aware like about this deeper value crisis. And I'd like to delve a little bit deeper into the social media arc that Hopkins has drawn. While thinking about the history of digitalization, I came across a formula that, although it's the basis of Boolean logic, and therefore digitalization, is not well known. George Boole asked himself what zero and one have in common. And it's simple. In both cases, we have a number that, when multiplied by itself, always results in the same value. 1 times 1 times 1 remains the same, just as 0 times 0 times 0 always results in 0. Formalizing this, we get to the formula x equals x to the n, which is a proliferation threat, isn't it? And this is where we can solve the mystery of the Jussie Smollett story. In the network, it's possible for an individual case, which statisticians call an outlier, to be recognized as normal. Because social viralization is built into social media, the scandal scales according to Metcalfe's law. So the statistical outlier turns into the norm, leading us to wonder if the scrupulous exploration of reality by data science is at a loss here. What do you think about that?
Well, so when you say, I think I know what you're getting at here, but you said that in social, first of all, one phrase I want to call out there is, I think, an important one, where you said you can get attention, but or you can earn attention, but you can't save attention.
You can't save, you, can you earn. Could save attention if you started programming, by the way, but very few people do.
No, I think that's actually a very important point. There's sort of, I mean, the parallel that comes to mind actually is cocaine.
Yeah,
where there are a lot of things that people desire, but that are really impossible, at least given a normal human level of safe self-control, to keep in reserve, mm-hmm. to use, to support mm-hmm. yourself when you really need them, something like that. So what you tend
machine.
To get on social media, and what we saw, what we saw with the hate hoaxers was mm-hmm. a very drug-like reaction, and I'd assume that's very common. If you are mm-hmm. someone who does OnlyFans, for example, even money aside, every day you'll post a sexy social video and you'll get 8,000 likes people will tell you how beautiful you are.
Dopamine.
There's no real reserve for that. If you stop for one day, it all goes away. You'll drop from 8,000 likes to 27 or whatever is the last few people trickle in and see it. So you have to keep going and you have to keep amping up your claims, both in the youth culture that this comes out of, where people are attempting to outdo one another in terms of victimization and so on, and on the social platforms mm-hmm. themselves. And I do think that's important. And that's why you see such extreme behavior. I mean, in terms of both things we're talking about, like OnlyFans has become essentially a prostitution platform. How do you get people to start doing this online and filming it? How do you get people to start lying in order to commit felonies? I mean, you amp up from a much, much lower base. I mean, initially it was people watching cars in bikinis, as I recall. Or recording terrible music and putting it online. So that thing, that first point, there's a drug-like cycling to this, I think is important. You can't save attention is a good line. In terms of the outlier becoming the norm, this may not be exactly what you're talking about, but one of the realities of platforms that most humans now engage in, the majority of Americans are European, something like 70% are on Facebook or Twitter or Instagram or Reddit. And where there are very few limits on behavior, I mean, the profile pictures for most people are anonymous Roman statues and the female symbol and this sort of thing. So everyone's there. There aren't a lot of social limits. Is that things that once were extremely niche now are fairly common. And so these extremely niche things can become mimetic. 30 or 40,000 people that share some kink or taste or lunatic thinking about politics can come together as a block and start harassing those that don't. And I mean, you see this with some serious things like the genocide in Gaza. But I mean, when you look at, say, the trans movement or the furry movement, I'm not putting these at the same level, but those are online facilitated movements. Those are case and state dependent movements. Like there's no way without Twitter, Reddit, 4chan, so on, either of those exists at anything like the level it does. If you're in your community and you just tell someone, I am a male, but I feel like I am a female, and specifically, I feel like I am a female fox, People are going to call for the men in the white coats. They're going to just assume you're crazy. If you say this online and you find out that around the world there are 2 million female foxes, now you have a community.
Which is Metcalfe's law. The fringe getting the norm.
So, in your book Taboo, you focus on a phenomenon you call the continuing oppressive narrative, or CON for short, which raises the question of how society can weave together certain extremely rare statistical outliers into a collective fabric that can be called psychotic. Freud used a little thought experiment to make the difference between a neurosis and a psychosis clear. He imagines a young woman standing by the deathbed of her sister, whose husband she madly loves. Now, she could say to herself, "Wonderful, I am free to express my love for him." But her piety stands in the way, which is the neurotic's way of suppressing her desire. But the psychotic solution is she convinces herself that the sister isn't dead at all. Using this distinction, we could say that the con society, which has committed itself to a continuing oppression, the narrative has become psychotic. It would seem that this assessment is disturbing to the sociologist who wants to establish something like a physical basis for social sciences. How do you deal with this, and what will your next book be about?
Well, those are in fact, I think, two different questions. So, I mean, I will say these are some of the best questions I've heard on a podcast. I mean, they're quite deep to some extent. Like, what does psychosis mean at the societal level and so on? I mean, I very often get asked things like, what's your favorite breed of dog? So, I mean, hopefully my answers aren't disappointing. But I mean, so first of all, I'll tackle the question itself in a second. But in Taboo, I introduced the idea of what I call the continuing oppression narrative. And I've long thought the acronym there was one of my better dry jokes. It just never got used, never hit
nice.
The base.
That's
exactly right. There's a chapter I discuss this. The abbreviation is CON, Continuing Oppression Narrative, the CON. And the idea of the continuing oppression narrative, I think, is really the core idea of what we call wokeness. So very often when you see left and right fighting in the journals or online, one of the claims made by the left side is, well, you guys can't even define what you're talking about. What do you mean by woke? Women being able to vote? And I think if you're an intelligent person on the right, their center right, the answer is clearly no. There's a core set of ideas here. Idea number one is that all of society, which is presented as facially neutral to most people, is in fact structured to oppress, you know, in parentheses, group X. So the core idea of, and all of this, by the way, is just sort of a dumbed down version of Marxism. I mean, we say that too much on the right. We call everyone a communist, but the root idea actually is a Marxist idea. Marx, who's drawing from Rousseau here and so on down the line, argues that economic systems, like the ability to open a small business, are in fact designed by the bourgeoisie to oppress the proletariat and the lumpen proletariat. All of society is this huge structured con game. Rousseau said this even about property rights, if I recall him correctly, that the social contract was established by the people who already had property and weapons to fossilize society as it then existed, to leave them in place as the top orders, the top stations within society. But every other critical theory to come along just took this basic framework, which is almost all of Marxism, other than the crackpot economics, and replaced the rich with something else. So in critical race theory, the rich man has been replaced by the white man. All of society is structured to benefit white people. You know, why are Asians and Nigerians doing so well? Well, they're basically white. So on down the line. You can argue about the intelligence of the theory, but that's the core idea. Fourth wave feminist theory, all of society is structured to benefit men. So, for example, marriage is designed to be a master-slave relationship that gives men as much access to sex as possible. And again, is that accurate as versus what happened during the sexual revolution as marriage declined? Probably not, but that's the theory, and so on into queer theory, fat studies, so on down the line. So continuing oppression narrative, point one is all of society is structured to oppress. Point two, which is really the killer, is any disparity in performance between groups is a sign of that oppression, which is what we opened on. So if there are black-white differences in mathematics scores on board tests, that's a sign of racism. And they will say that the only other potential cause there would be genetic inferiority. Do you want to believe in that? Wink, nudge. In reality, of course, we know that age, study time, so on play a huge role. But that's point two. And point three is that the solution is equity. which basically means stripped of gaudy language, proportional representation regardless of performance. So when someone yes. says that a firm engages in equitable hiring of executives, I mean, I've been at a reasonably high level in a number of different universities and mm-hmm. businesses. What that means in practice is if the country's 12% black, we're going to have 12% blacks in these roles. I've never seen it mean anything else. So the continuing oppression narrative is just 1, 2, 3. Society is institutionally structured today to oppress. Gaps between groups are evidence of that oppression. The only solution is equity. And you guys are absolutely right that today, to make that argument, what you're doing very often is over highlighting fringe cases. So if you're arguing that black people who perform equally to white people are institutionally oppressed in the USA, you have a pretty tough case of it. I mean, since 1967, we, like many other countries, have had institutional affirmative action and diversity forward programs in place. So, I mean, in sure. practice, when I applied to law school, and I was actually aware of this, I went to a school where my scores were about on par, not well below. Mm-hmm. But when I applied to law school, I got a 10 to 15 point LSAT boost at most of the schools I was applying to. That's pretty standard. So to argue that the reverse is occurring, that old school racism is still very prevalent, you have to point to individual things like the George Floyd case, Jacob Blake case, and so on, and kind of knit them into this essentially made up patchwork quilt of oppression. Now, when you guys, and last point for me, but when you guys say, does that make society a bit psychotic? I don't know about all of society. I think it makes a lot of people more than a little bit mm-hmm. crazy. Or more than a little bit faithful might be a better way to put it. I mean, the idea that it's astonishing that people believe such stupid things because they're told to by leaders who they think of as good, that actually does not strike me as a particularly new or unusual phenomenon. You know, the standard belief in the United States used to be that the world was made by God exactly 6,000 years ago over the course of 7 days. And you were likely to become a bit of a social outcast if you didn't profess belief in, you know, forgive me, this nonsense. So now we have a new set of nonsensical beliefs promoted by social leaders, and most people politely adhere to them. I mean, I think that's all that's going on. But there does have to be a disconnect that comes up fairly often. I see this often talking to feminists, actually. And I don't mean to talk about like these sort of sideline dating issues and so on. But one of the core fourth wave positions is that all differences between the sexes are socially constructed in a somewhat evil society run by men. But this is obviously not true. The average man weighs 80 pounds more than the average woman, and much of that is muscle, so on down the line. So I've had a lot of close feminist friends over the years as a non-sexist person who went to college. And whenever I ask basic questions like, well, don't you prefer aggressive, masculine guys? There'll be this incredible separation between the theory and the reality. The theory is that no one would want this unless they have been brainwashed by evildoers. The reality is, of course, 95% of women would prefer this, and 95% of men like attractive, pleasant women and so on. So for a lot of individual people, trying to reconcile the claim of brutal oppression of minorities with the reality that you were rejected by every dental school you applied to because you were Caucasian, yeah, that causes a great deal of internal struggle, as all nonsense ideas do. You know, why do the gods allow suffering and so on?
I'm kind of fascinated by the, because having really experienced that firsthand, having read Foucault in the 80s, etc., that all of a sudden a very like a fringe understanding of the general toxicity of society became kind of mainstream. And all of a sudden, like ideas of identity flipped around and turned a negative identity, meaning kind of like a victim state, etc. So my explanation, like having dealt with the history of digitization, is really we undergo a deep, deep, deep value crisis, and people don't cope with that. So they pay attention, but they don't save attention. That would mean, okay, understanding a new way. So what I do see and what I find extremely irritating in this way is that even like not only like the downtrodden, etc., getting to moments of resentment, but also elites. Like And this also, I always recall the sentence articulated famously and infamously articulated by Hitler, who said, if the Jew didn't exist, we had to invent the Jew. So that's a weird sentence, because nowadays one has the feeling that the perpetrator has to be invented all day long. What you told about, like, the none of these women in the dating world mm-hmm. won't admit to be just white, because the perpetrator has been just a mythical figure, etc. And this is, for me, a weird moment. And so what's your if you step back a little bit, like, and telling your child, for example, how society got mad, like, in 30 years later on, so what would be your science fiction story?
Well, my science fiction story, I'd probably fancy it up a little bit to involve actual brain worms or something like that. Like, this is the poison spread gets at a great metaphor for this in his book on parasitic ideas. But I think that what has happened is that people have come to adopt, I mean, when we all agreed on the term Maya earlier, I think this would be a new form of it. I actually am really, really negatively inclined towards systems that add unnecessary complexity to the world. And I think that a lot of moral systems do this.
Yeah.
The combination of being almost pragmatically amoral after being trained in a modern social science and then having some personal virtue ethics strikes me as probably the best way to be human. What should you do? Well, what you want to do, unless it hurts other people past a point X. That's it. I'm pretty sure I could defend that position against pretty much any other philosophical position designed by man at great length over beer or coffee. So when people come up with these very complex systems that complexitize the world for no reason, I just find them irritating. This is actually one of my beefs with feminism, by the way. It's perfectly fine to say men and women are different. We want full legal equality. Claiming that every difference between the two groups is caused by subtle manipulation from the opposite sex is not only nonsensical, there are 8 or 9 points where you could just unpack that, but is also often unfalsifiable. It's just a thing one can think that does not help explain reality, if that makes sense. So, kind of getting back to the point, I think that a lot of people have adopted another wholly useless and non-additional, is the phrase that would come to my mind, moral system. And that moral system is based upon the continuing oppression narrative. So the ideas would be threefold. And again, these are unfalsifiable at least half the time, in at least half of individual cases. But one, society is structured to oppress you, probably. Two, all disparities are evidence of this. And three, we need equity to solve this. So if you believe this, it's going to lead you down a range of negative paths.
Sure.
I mean, for example, when I hear people arguing for opening America or Europe's borders, it's almost always an argument that's rooted in these preconditional assumptions. One is that the world system is structured to oppress. It's usually just Lenin's colonialism, the last stage of capitalism, or imperialism, the last stage of capitalism. Two, all gaps in performance between different nations are due to this. So Somalis raised under American conditions would perform as well as Americans. And three, the solution is some kind of equalization across national lines. Now, in reality, this is crazy. There are massive numbers of cultural, historical, regional, stochastic, so on, differences between human groups. That's the basis of, some would argue, genetic. That's the basis for, I'm primarily a culturalist, if not entirely one. But at any rate, that's the basis for political science. So the argument is not correct. I think you may have guessed, if not noticed, my take on it. But is very, very prevalent and pervasive, and it underlies a lot of the confusion we're seeing in society. So what I would tell a kid is, you know, because of the alien brain worms from the planet of Pamplona or something, people started believing these three ideas, and so they came to crazy conclusions, such as the idea that you need to tear down any system that produces inequality. And that's, by the way, I will say that's not an exaggeration, and there is a potential. There's a goal almost of human extinction to some of these people. If you really sit down and talk with some of the eco-lunatics, for example. Mm-hmm. I mean, a list of things that produces inequality would include capitalism, the market, education, mathematics and English testing. I suppose it's part of education, just on and on and on. So you're now seeing major American cities do things like, in essence, legalize theft, because it turns out that at least a slightly disproportionate number of thieves are Black. So in San Francisco, and this is not an exaggeration.
That's my home. That's where I live. San Francisco.
Really? Oh, you're, yes. You're from San Francisco.
I'm from San Francisco. Yes, and it's horrid. It's absolutely horrid.
Yeah, I mean, I have a good number of friends that are young tech exec types that live in the area, and the the videos you see online of people, as you know, of course, of people walking into boutiques and stealing exactly, what is it, $949 worth of goods?
Exactly. And
then walking out. I mean, the idea, of course, is that if you steal more than $950 or $1,000 worth of merchandise, you're still a thief, you're still a felon. But under that, because we don't want to punish the petty thief that's just stealing to eat, there's no penalty. Mm-hmm. Now, of course, no one's going to the Sephora store and just stealing to eat. It would be pretty easy to target this law if you were to pass such a crazy law at all. But all of this is caused by the brain worm. Anything that causes gaps is bad. So, yeah, I mean, this, that's the explanation that I would give. Does it require, and this is a brief last answer, but does it require a kind of invented villain to believe this? I think so.
We had a wonderful talk with a psychoanalyst who came up with a very surprising remark. And he said to me, and I laughed out loud because it was so beautiful. He said, I'm a contemporary of Shakespeare. Fair is foul and foul is fair. So I guess we are living in a very weird world. And maybe it's kind of nice to have a comedy with brain worms and the like. Mr. Riley, there was a wonderful, wonderful conversation. Hope you had also a little bit fun. And
of course.
Yeah.
We thank you. Wonderful.
Great. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you. Thank you, gentlemen, for having me on. I greatly enjoyed talking.
Yeah.